It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we know now that Wisconsin Legislative Special Counsel Michael Gableman has a contract to continue his investigation into the 2020 presidential election. But a judge in one of the open records lawsuits against the special counsel says their documents reveal not much of an investigation, at least so far. But first, funding for school districts in Wisconsin. It's been a hot-button political issue for decades, and it's been exacerbated in recent years by declining enrollment and now the pandemic. So some Wisconsin school districts have turned to private sponsorships and naming rights to help pay for athletic facilities and programs. Perhaps you've seen them. While others have received charitable donations that help fund capital projects for academics. Perhaps you've heard about them. It raises some ethical questions about whether private businesses should be allowed to have their branding advertised on public school facilities, or if it's a harmless way to provide more funding at a time when schools are looking for just that. Be interested in knowing and hearing from you. Our guest today researches school funding in Wisconsin and the challenges our system faces. What do you think? 1-800-642-1234. Do you see a problem with private businesses sponsoring public school, field, gym, or pavilions? What kind of restrictions do you think there should be over private sponsorships at schools across Wisconsin? Got a couple comments up on Facebook, on our Ideas Network Facebook page that we'll get to, and you can always comment there or call us now at 1-800-642-1234. Andrew Rushofsky is a professor emeritus of public affairs and applied economics at the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Andrew, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Let's start with some basics. I know this is a complicated formula, or there are complicated formulas, plural, but to give us an overview of funding for public schools in Wisconsin, you're the expert. How does it look from 10,000 feet up?
Well, I might start by saying that I and many people who look at school funding in Wisconsin think that the system is broken, doesn't work well. And basically, we fund schools with a mixture of local property tax revenues and revenues from state aid and a little bit of federal revenues. And one thing that characterizes Wisconsin's school funding system that you don't find, I think, in any other state is that the state has imposed a revenue limit on schools. And it's a revenue limit that is the sum of what is called general state aid, most of 80% of total state funding for schools, plus property tax revenues. And this was instituted in 1994. And in the first decade or so, the amount that districts could raise, and that's effectively spend, went up by about the rate of inflation. But in the last decade or so, that annual adjustment, as it's called, has, in one case, it went negative, and in recent years, including the current budget, it is absolutely zero. So that means that any increase in state aid has to be offset with a reduction in property taxes. And the bottom line is that schools end up with no extra revenue, despite the fact that the costs of education continue to rise.
Andrew, some school districts now have turned to naming rights sponsorships from private businesses to help fund their athletics facilities. How recent of a phenomenon is this?
I'm not exactly sure, but I think this kind of phenomenon has been going on in various states for a number of years. Schools across the country facing constraints in terms of public funding have looked for donations from individuals, donations from businesses, voluntary contributions. And that's been going on, I think, for decades. And maybe there's an upsurge now in naming rights, but I'm not actually sure.
An article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel recently detailing some of the naming rights that have been sold off in Wisconsin schools across the state. And Andrew, what sort of regulations do we see on these sort of naming rights and sponsorships at public schools?
That's a good question, and I don't really know the answer. It's obviously the answer is different in Wisconsin and in other states. As far as I know, there are not any state regulations for local districts to decide to give naming rights as a way of generating revenue.
Do we know what sort of revenue it generates? Are there big dollars behind these names?
as far as I know, the state does not collect data on naming right revenue. They do collect data on revenue that districts generate from selling ticket sales and miscellaneous sources of revenue. And on the whole, those miscellaneous revenues across the whole state and across all school districts account for a few percent at most of total revenues of school districts. So it's not an important source of funding in the broader picture, although for an individual district that's struggling to educate its children, being able to improve facilities by gaining some revenue or a naming right for an existing facility, which then allows that revenue to be used for general education, even if it's a small amount relative to the total budget of schools, it can make a big difference.
Andrew Rashofsky is a professor emeritus of public affairs and applied economics at the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs in UW-Madison, looking at alternatives to funding sources for schools across Wisconsin and the rise in reports of naming rights and sponsorships we've seen at Wisconsin schools, and whether or not it's something you would support at your local school at 1-800-642-1234. And we have a comment here, as mentioned before, on Facebook. Paul writes on our Facebook page, our Ideas Network Facebook page, "I think it shows clearly our tax policies are wildly out of whack. We shouldn't be depending upon corporate charity to provide services guaranteed by the state's constitution. Any company with enough profit to buy a community a school should be paying more in taxes so working families don't have to carry that whole burden." Andrew, what's your reaction to Paul's thought on this?
I think I generally agree with Paul that states have a responsibility, the foundation of that is in the state constitution. There's an education clause, and across the country, in fact, courts, not in Wisconsin, have argued that states are responsible for providing what generally is called an adequate education for all their students. And arguably, that's not happening in Wisconsin. And that doesn't prevent some school districts from saying if they want to have an extra fancy sports facilities to look for private funding. But it is worrisome when school districts are forced to go after private corporate funding as just a way of maintaining basic education.
Lynn from our Facebook page said, "If businesses want to support a school project with a donation, that's great, but we don't need to give them a permanent advertising by putting their names on buildings or fields. A brass plaque should be sufficient." And I guess that would go to the heart of what individual districts decide what works for themselves when it comes to sponsorship or naming rights in these schools, Andrew.
I think it's a decision that we should allow local school districts to make. It's unfortunate they're in a situation where they are desperate for revenue, but if a donor comes and is willing to contribute a substantial amount of money, and the price for that is putting their name on some facility, whether it's a plaque or a big sign, that's given the circumstances, that's probably all right.
So another comment from our Facebook page as they come in, the Ideas Network Facebook page, a little lively this afternoon with our Central Time topic, also calls at 1-800-642-1234. Here's what Joan had to say. "We've had two insurance companies donate to update or build new portions of the high school. Other than their names over the door, we've not seen or heard any undue influence. This was a win for the taxpayers." And, you know, when you talk about the imposed revenue limit on schools that came down in Wisconsin in 1994, that was supposed to be a win for the taxpayers, too. Are the taxpayers being protected through this in some way, Andrew, as you see it?
I think basically no. And let me try to explain why not. The way the revenue limit works is there's a limit on total general aid and property tax revenue. So the state, as it did in the current budget that we're living through now, the biennial budget, it increased general aid, but it didn't change at all the revenue limits. And that forces districts to cut their property tax levy. But how do they do that? The only way they can do that is by lowering the rate. And think about what that does. Lowering the rate means that you pay somewhat lower property taxes, but all every owner of property within the school district also pays lower property tax. And that includes owners of vacation property who don't live in the state. It includes businesses. They could be a business that's incorporated in Europe, foreign businesses or in other states. We spread out property tax relief. The term that I use is untargeted. It goes to absolutely every owner of property. And the larger the value of your property, the larger the tax break you get. As a net result, the proportion of property tax breaks that goes to homeowners, particularly to homeowners who face a high burden, pay a lot of taxes relative to their income, presume taxpayers that we might as a state want to assist, get a fairly small share of the total tax break that's effectively mandated through revenue caps. So it's not a very successful way of giving property tax relief. And we've been following this approach for years. And in the end, you might think that, oh, property tax revenues in school revenues in Wisconsin must be lower than the national average. But in fact, they're still above the national average, although they've come down.
We're talking to UW Madison Professor Emeritus Andrew Rushofsky about school district funding in Wisconsin and the role of donations and sponsorships. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-123. Had a couple of comments on our Ideas Network Facebook page where you can join the debate there. Do you think private business sponsorships should be treated differently than donations to school districts? And would you be okay with more advertising and naming rights if it reduced the need for a referendum every year? Do you have any ethical concerns about businesses putting their names on public school facilities? And do you think students care? 1-800-642-1234. Number to join our conversation with Andrew Rushofsky is 1-800-642-1234. Conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and we're picking up the conversation with Andrew Rushofsky, Public Affairs Professor and Emeritus from UW-Madison, on how Wisconsin can fund schools, how Wisconsin does fund schools, and how Wisconsin should fund schools. And we're interested in hearing from you still before our time is up at 1-800-642-1234. What kind of changes would you like to see for school funding in Wisconsin? As we continue here, Andrew, I do want to ask about referenda, which come, for school districts, it comes around quite often, and it is a call for extra additional funding from school districts that can't find it, as in part as a result of the imposed revenue limits on schools. It dates back to 1994. What do you, in terms of school funding, how do you view referenda?
Well, referenda are a way of, and really the only way, for school districts and citizens within school districts to override the revenue limit, to say, okay, we are willing to pay higher property taxes to increase spending on our schools. And process has existed since 1994. And one interesting thing are that the proportion of districts that are going to referenda has been increasing, and the proportion of successful referenda has increased over time. And I think that reflects the desperation that so many districts face in how do we provide education for our children. In some cases, they face rising costs, but they are unable to spend more money, not even adjustments for inflation. And in some sense, thank goodness for having referenda, at least it allows some districts to spend more money. But it is, the evidence shows it's much easier for districts that are relatively small, often high-income districts, to enact and successfully pass referenda than big districts with substantial amounts of low-income and diverse populations. And so over time, it counteracts the effort of state aid to equalize funding and provides more inequalities in the funding of education within a state.
And as we've been talking about school funding here, I would be remiss if we did not bring up private schools and how they factor into the complications of funding formulas for education in Wisconsin. So, Andrew, do private schools have the same types of restrictions for outside funding as part of the Wisconsin Department of Instruction? Or would they, in theory, be allowed to, well, say, sell sponsorships, take donations for anything?
As far as I know, private schools are not subject to any constraints and restraint on their ability to raise revenue. And if you like at universities also, you go around and buildings have people's names, names of donors, classrooms have names. And so the reliance on private donations from individuals and from businesses in the private sector is even greater than the public sector.
One example in Beloit, Diane Hendricks and other business leaders there formed a nonprofit organization, Kids First Beloit, that then funded a new public charter school called the Lincoln Academy to compete with the school district of Beloit. So with that in mind, Andrew, what kind of ways are there for private citizens and organizations to work around some of these school funding challenges that we've been seeing?
I mean, in part, one might argue that if you care about the funding, if you care about public education in Wisconsin, and you want to improve the funding of, and the equity in funding of public education, one, as a private citizen, ought to be lobbying our legislature to try to fix what is essentially a broken system. Failing that, if you don't think that your school district or your children or your neighbor's children go to school have enough resources, I think people can try to donate, try to help out.
Why work to fix?
Is that going to make a big difference? Yeah. Probably not.
Well, why you talk about, and you know, we started with how the funding formulas in your, as from your research, is broken for Wisconsin education, and it needs to be fixed. But what about the argument that you know, maybe starting from scratch or starting from a different place altogether? I mean, what do you see in your studies, Andrew, that would work going forward? Where do we begin to find some equity here, and where do we begin to find a way to pay for the future of Wisconsin?
So I talked about, and we've been discussing, the revenue limits, which place an incredible constraint on school districts. And the pattern of spending that we saw in 1994 has sort of been frozen over time, more or less. And we've frozen in inequity. So that's one issue. But the other issue is the way that we distribute state aid, general aid equalization formula. Our formula in Wisconsin takes account to a good degree of the property wealth of different districts, but it pays almost no attention to the fact that some districts have to spend more money to educate their kids than other districts. And that reflects, on the one hand, small rural districts where have few students but still have to provide a whole array of education. And on the other hand, that different compositions of student bodies generate different costs. So a school district that has lots of students who don't come to school speaking English and lots of students from low-income families have to spend a lot more money to achieve any educational standard than a district that has middle and upper middle class students who come to school already prepared, whose parents can buy them computers and school supplies and so forth. And our formula takes almost no account of differences in poverty, for instance. And that's in striking contrast to most other states, which have used various means, including weighted pupils. So if you have students from low-income families, they count as, let's say, a student and a half, giving more state aid to those districts that have concentrations of what we might call high-need students. And we don't do that in Wisconsin.
Andrew Roshofsky is a professor emeritus of public affairs and applied economics at the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Let's go to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, where Ben in La Crosse is standing by. Ben, good afternoon. You're on Central Time.
Hi. couple of points. One of them is prior to the 1994 change in the legislation, school boards could enact whatever taxes they wanted on their districts. And we had a situation where property taxes, the school portion of property taxes was going up 10% or more per year, year over year. It was a problem that that legislation was designed to solve. Secondly, the issue of who pays the property taxes is because the situation is inequitable because residential property owners wind up paying approximately 75% of all property taxes in the state because special interests have lobbied to get their property tax burden reduced. Thirdly, it's a situation where as enrollment goes up, the costs go up for education in a school district. But apparently as enrollment goes down, which is what's happening throughout the state, costs continue to go up.
Ben, we're short on time, and I appreciate the 3 points, but I want to give enough time for Andrew to respond. Andrew?
Those are complicated issues. Just let me say that they are ways to limit and constrain growth in property tax revenue that are not as draconian as our current revenue limits that have lots of unintended consequences.
Do you see any momentum for funding changes on education in Wisconsin, Andrew?
I hope so. I think what's happening over time is that more people around the state, and this is rich districts, poor districts, conservative and liberal political areas, are all saying, wait a minute, we don't have enough funding for our schools. And this is becoming a crisis across the state in all sorts of districts. And that's probably a prerequisite for the political momentum to think about reform.
Andrew, really appreciate you joining us today. Thank you.
Sure, my pleasure.
Andrew Ruschowski, Professor Emeritus of Public Affairs and Applied Economics at the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. With us today to look at how we fund our schools and how that may change or stay the same. Coming up after the news, 700 pages released from the Wisconsin Legislative Special Counsel's investigation into the 2020 presidential election, and the judge in this open records case is challenging the public to find evidence of any investigation within these newly available documents. That's next. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, we learn how anthropology is being used to solve cold cases in northeastern Wisconsin. But first, the investigation into Wisconsin's 2020 presidential election by former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gabelman is ongoing with a new contract issued by Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. But Democrats and now some Republicans are raising new questions about the validity of the effort after a Dane County judge ordered the release of hundreds of pages of public records from this investigation, showing an apparent lack of progress, according to the judge. We're learning more about what these documents reveal about the investigation and where Gabelman's efforts might go from here. You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Interested in knowing how you feel about the Gabelman investigation, whether or not you want to see it continue. Do you think the 2020 election in Wisconsin needs more scrutiny? Or do you think Voss and Republicans need to move on? 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page anytime. Our guest is Jack Kelly, Wisconsin politics reporter for the Cap Times. Jack, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
I'm glad you can suss it out for us. Michael Gabelman filed his report and gave his recommendations to the Assembly Committee last week, but it appears to be another interim report. So what is left for him to do now with this new contract?
So that's a great question. The language here has been a little confusing. Speaker Robin Voss had been referring to this as his final report for weeks before it came out. And then, of course, at that hearing before the Committee on Campaigns and Elections, he was referring to it as his second interim report. What work is still to be done from here? It's a little unclear. The new contract itself kind of lays this out for us. It says that now that he has filed this report, that he should focus on, it says right in the contract, quote, will concentrate its efforts to obtain the necessary documents and testimony to complete its investigation. So basically from here, it seems as if the speaker wants the Office of Special Counsel, which of course is run by Michael Gableman, to go forward and kind of settle some of these lawsuits about subpoenas. He has asked to put the mayors of Madison and Green Bay in jail. It seems from here, the speaker is hoping that the Office of Special Counsel will continue to try to flesh out some of this ongoing litigation to determine the authority of the legislature going forward in case they ever wanted to pursue another investigation like this.
Jack, how far back does this investigation now go?
Well, it's been going on for quite some time. It started in earnest last summer. And this is the second contract extension that we have seen for Gableman. Initially, the review was scheduled to end October 31st and then December 31st. And then Gableman actually operated kind of in contractual limbo for a couple of months. And then on Tuesday, we finally saw an updated contract. So it goes all the way back and really commenced in earnest when Speaker Voss announced it at the state party convention last summer. Of course, this came shortly after a meeting that Speaker Voss had with former President Donald Trump. This has been going on for months, and it has shifted in scope at times. And, last week we finally kind of got a look behind the scenes with this 136-page second interim report, as they're calling it.
Well, is that more behind the scenes than the 761 pages that was released as a result of one of the, I think, three open records cases against the special counsel right now?
Yeah, so that's interesting. There are three cases ongoing. All three of them were brought by a liberal watchdog group called American Oversight, which is headquartered in D.C., but they sue government agencies all around the country for public records. So the records released by the judge this week, the judge said this. He said during a hearing that it seems that this was much ado about nothing. There was a lot. They fought this for months. They fought the release of these documents for months, and the documents showed very little as it related to the investigation itself. The interim report made similar, you can have similar takeaways from the interim report. Gableman makes a lot of claims. Obviously, he made his recommendations. There is not a ton of information to back up some of the things that he says. I'd have to look at the report again, but I'm fairly certain he goes through the whole 136-page report and doesn't even include footnotes to kind of support some of the claims that he's making. So both the documents released on Tuesday by a judge and the interim report, as the judge said, it shows that, the Office of Special Counsel and Gableman, they have not pursued a ton in their review, even though it's been going on for several months now.
Jack Kelly's our guest, Wisconsin politics reporter for the Cap Times. Interested in what you think about this ongoing special counsel investigation into the 2020 presidential election at 1-800-642-1234. These 761 pages released earlier this week as a result of a decision from a Dane County Circuit judge. What do they reveal? What do they include? What's in this tome?
Yeah, so this is a great question. I think any journalist loves the opportunity to page through 700 plus pages of documents. Some of them were repeats. There were a handful of times where I found myself at page 400 in the PDF and was kind of confused because I had already read something. Some things that they show, Eric Cardall, who is a conservative attorney, works with a law firm based in Minneapolis. Works with another organization called the Thomas More Society, which I believe is subletting office space from the special counsel at their office in Brookfield, seems to have been heavily involved in the review. He makes all sorts of connections for Michael Gableman. At one point, I'm fairly certain he started the process of reaching out to kind of a PR management consulting company in Chicago on behalf of the Office of Special Counsel. And it's important to keep in mind here that Eric Cardall is not one of the publicly announced members of the review staff. Gableman told us this a couple hearings ago about who was all on his staff, and Cardall was not one of them.
But he and Jack, you're saying that it seems as though he may have rented some space with the special counsel's office?
Yeah, so he works with this group called the Thomas More Society. And they're a conservative group, and they're involved in a lot of election related, projects and lawsuits. And
he did. Didn't he sue to try to decertify, but stop the certification of the presidential election? Is that Eric Cardall?
Yes, he was representing the Wisconsin Voters Alliance, which is the president, Ron Hoyer, of the Wisconsin Voters Alliance. Hoyer is actually a paid member of Gabelman's review staff. So, so his emails reviewed that this relationship between the two of them seems to be much closer than previously known. Now, obviously, we knew they were working together. Cardall testified immediately after Gabelman last week before the assembly committee. Cardall conducted a series of interviews with nursing home residents that Gabelman showed during his testimony. So we knew it was there, but it showed that he seemed to be coordinating a lot on behalf of the Office of Special Counsel. So that was interesting. Another thing, you know, we see an email and they're talking about office supplies and how to organize documents. And at this point, they you know, in theory, were weeks or months into the review. So the documents were really interesting. It was not, you know, a substantial look that they had found a lot of wrongdoing in the Wisconsin election, but it was an interesting look into the inner workings of the Office of Special Counsel and just how they pursued this review over the last several months.
Worth reiterating the Dane County Circuit Judge Frank Remington's statement from the bench when he ordered the release of these 761 pages earlier this week, and that is he challenged the public to go through these and find what he said would be an argument that there has been an investigation, much less the conclusions that have been made by the Office of Special Counsel. Are there more documents to be obtained?
Potentially. You know, obviously, their Wisconsin public records law is fairly open and is fairly robust, but there are some interesting exceptions, right? Lawmakers, legislators, members of the legislature do not have to preserve documents unless they are requested by someone. So, you know, unless a member of the public or a journalist requests records, lawmakers are allowed to delete them. They don't have to preserve them. So there is some discussion about whether documents related to the review were deleted after a public records request came in. Just today, some new developments happened in another one of the open records lawsuits where an attorney for American Oversight said that an attorney for Speaker Rob Voss had access to records that had been deleted, and it was going to be up to a different Dane County judge to determine if they were to be released. So there's potentially more documents to come. What those documents will tell us, we'd have to wait and see until we actually have access to them.
Jack Kelly, Wisconsin politics reporter for the Capital Times. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234 if you've got a question about the Wisconsin legislators' special counsel investigation in the 2020 and presidential election. This is the place to have it. And Jack, some of the documents that were released earlier this week from the open records request include subpoenas, some which were never issued, some that have not been signed. And I understand these subpoenas have to be signed by the Speaker of the Legislature, Robin Voss, as well as another. What's your takeaway from these subpoenas that were part of this document release?
So subpoenas have to be signed by both Speaker Voss as well as the Assembly Chief Clerk. The subpoenas are kind of all over the map. So Representative Mark Spreitzer, who's a Democrat from Beloit, who is a Democratic member of the Assembly Committee on Campaigns and Elections, posted 86, I believe, subpoenas to his legislative website yesterday. An aide to Spreitzer told me that these subpoenas came from the first batch of subpoenas that Gabelman issued, which were back in early October, as well as some of the ones that he issued in December. They show how wide-ranging the review has been. Obviously, you know, two of the big elements that we know now that Gabelman's team has been focused on are how was voting handled at nursing homes during the pandemic? Obviously, the Racine County Sheriff did a report about this. Gabelman pursued it. And also, how was grant funding from a private organization called the Center for Tech and Civic Life, which is a nonprofit, used by municipalities as a part of election administration? So the subpoenas, which are issued to a wide range of people, both in and out of Wisconsin, show the wide-ranging nature of the review and shows, you know, the somewhat haphazard nature of the review. You know, experts have told me that this seems to have been a haphazard review. You know, you talk to election administration experts, someone like Barry Burden at UW-Madison or Trey Grayson, who's the Republican former Secretary of State of Kentucky, you know, the former chief election official in Kentucky. If you're going to do a review of an election, they can be beneficial. They can be useful. You should do it. It's an exercise in good government. But they always say there should be very clear parameters set out. What are you trying to determine? How long do you have? How are you doing that? And the subpoenas show that you know, these things seem to have really come and gone as different developments came out. His team started to pursue different leads. So the subpoenas were really interesting. Also, that list from Spreitzer is not comprehensive. He has 86 of them. The speaker said recently in a radio interview that he has issued more than 100 of them. I recently obtained a subpoena that was issued in February. So, you know, as recently as last month, they were still issuing subpoenas. So it's interesting. It shows the wide ranging nature of it. But it's hard to glean exactly what they have learned from these subpoenas.
We're talking with Cap Times reporter Jack Kelly about the latest in the Michael Gableman investigation of the 2020 presidential election in Wisconsin. And we want to hear from you. We got calls around the bend at 1-800-642-1234. Get your reaction, what you think about Michael Gableman, whether or not you trust him, and what will come of his special counsel investigation. You can always comment on our Ideas Network Facebook page, and our conversation continues next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and we're picking up our talk with Jack Kelly, Wisconsin politics reporter from the Capital Times, with us to take us through a new set of documents, hundreds made public from former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman's investigation into Wisconsin's 2020 presidential election. What do you think? 1-800-642-1234. And Jack, since you were talking about Eric Cardall and the work that they have, this private attorney from Minnesota has done, at least apparently in conjunction with the Wisconsin special counsel investigation. And I saw Michael Gableman was on Tucker Carlson with Fox News earlier this week. Where is the argument of impartiality into this investigation? Is there one?
You know, this is interesting. Democratic members of the Assembly Committee that is purportedly overseeing this investigation, asked Michael Gableman during last week's hearing, why should the people of Wisconsin trust you? And he actually became borderline emotional in responding to it. You know, he gave a long kind of talk about how he's committed himself to public service. He was a circuit court judge, of course, was on the Supreme Court. But he did admit and kind of danced around the answer to why should people trust him. But he did come out and say that he voted for Donald Trump. Obviously, he's made previous statements, unfounded statements about votes being stolen by the Elections Commission, I believe is what he said. it's from the jump, there have been questions about the impartiality, right? This was a review that received no bipartisan support. It was supported only by Assembly Republicans, and largely has continued to be supported only, or pretty much has only been supported by Republicans throughout the duration, though some Republicans now are even being skeptical of it. That was a question that they asked, and Michael Gableman did not have a great answer to it last week during the committee.
That's Jack Kelly from the Cap Times. Now we go to you, and we'll start with Randy in Madison. Randy, good afternoon. You're on Central Time.
Good afternoon. I'm particularly disturbed. I've done quite a few, been a poll worker on quite a few elections. And the election officials I've dealt with, and I'm speaking here in Madison, are some of the most competent and people of the highest integrity I've ever known, in very marked contrast to these investigators. Like I said, I'm very disturbed that the point of the investigation seems to be to smear these people because they work in cities like Madison, Milwaukee, Green Bay, maybe La Crosse, where the votes will tend to go for the Democrats.
Randy, I appreciate the perspective, and it's something I've heard before, and I've seen the clerks actually put out their own ad in Wisconsin about the work that they do, and maybe little was known about it. But, you know, what are some of the responses from clerks across the state into this investigation?
Yeah, I mean, clerks... are often underspoken people. Yeah. You know, they're diligent workers. They serve their local communities. So we hear less from the clerk, but let's take the city of Madison, for example. We don't hear from the clerk directly, but we hear a lot from the mayor of Madison, Satya Rhodes Conway, who is a fierce critic of this review. Obviously, you know, Michael Gableman has asked a Waukesha County judge to put her in jail for shrugging his subpoena. She's been you know, she, I think they've used the term fraudit. They have, you know, they've been very critical. You almost run out of adjectives that they've used talking about the review. Now, so it's a little bit hard to say what clerks think, but I will say that, you know, we've seen evidence. Barry Burden from UW-Madison did a survey of municipal clerks, because obviously municipal clerks are the lifeblood of Wisconsin elections. Wisconsin has a very decentralized election system. And he found a high burnout rate among election clerks. I don't have the exact figures in front of me, but he found a high burnout rate. So the stress of the 2020 election and its aftermath is definitely taking a toll on municipal clerks around the state.
Let's go to Mary in Wauwatosa. Mary, good afternoon. You're on Central Time.
Hi. I agree with the previous caller. I also want to say that I'm outraged that our taxpayer money has gone to fund this flim-flam con man's job, which now I hear wasn't very well done anyway. And the fact that he's got more money coming to him to do this is ridiculous. I think everybody should be embarrassed who has given him approval to do this. And frankly, I'm embarrassed that this man was a Wisconsin Supreme Court justice.
Mary, thank you for the call. And I feel like maybe Speaker Voss's attempt to, at some degree, you know, placate this investigation, but at other times, you know, make clear that there's no decertification that is available for the 2020 election under the law as we know it. And that seems to be pretty uniform of a statement. So what about, you know, some of the Republicans and how they have had to how they've had to take a side on this investigation?
Yeah, one thing I should mention that Mary pointed out. So the contract extension between Voss and Gableman goes to the end of April. It does not actually include an increase in Gableman's budget. He's still operating under that initial $676,000.
Okay.
The one exception to that being that, you know, Speaker Voss did say that the assembly will cover, you know, legal costs for some of this ongoing litigation. So in theory, there could be more expense to taxpayers there, but the actual budget has not been increased. In terms of Republicans having to navigate this, you know, it has definitely been interesting to watch. We have seen, you know, several, I might be up to 10 now, I would have to double check, you know, county Republican parties who want to see Speaker Voss replaced. Hmm. We have seen some members of the Senate, someone like Kathy Bernier, who is retiring, who's been a big skeptic and critic of the review.
She's a former clerk herself, right?
Right, a former municipal clerk herself, former, you know, election official for,
and
I think,
it's interesting,
years.
Jack, because she is the outgoing chair of the Senate Elections Committee, but then in the Assembly Elections Committee, you have Janelle Branchon, who was even recently made mention of or called into question the integrity of Wisconsin's elections.
Yeah, I mean, Representative Branchon was in attendance at an, you know, an air quotes election integrity rally at the Wisconsin Capitol a few weeks ago. She was appearing alongside State Rep Timothy Rampton, who is, you know, also now a GOP gubernatorial candidate. And, you know, they were pushing for kind of peddling these ideas that there was some wrongdoing with Wisconsin's election in 2020.
Jack, I got to ask you, since you've been watching it all, what are you looking for next?
What am I looking for next? That's a great question. You know, I am interested in the outcome of some of this litigation. Now, this is a more technical answer than you were probably expecting, but the outcome of this litigation could really define the scope of the legislature's ability to do future investigations. You know, if a judge determines that these subpoenas that Gableman has been issuing aren't valid because they're seeking to compel testimony in private rather than in front of the committee, that could, you know, change the way that a potential future investigation would, you know, play out. Obviously, you know, as a politics reporter, I'm very interested in knowing whether or not a Waukesha County judge will actually go forward and try to jail Madison Mayor Saatchi Rhodes Conway and a handful of other Wisconsin officials. So I think that's interesting. I think, you know, we waited for a long time for this second interim report because Speaker Voss had told us they wanted to legislate based off the findings of the report. Of course, the legislature is now out of session. They have they passed a flurry of election related bills, most of which will be vetoed by Governor Tony Evers. So it will be interesting. I think, you know, the review is winding down, but it's really going to fall into this litigation now.
Jack Kelly, really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Jack Kelly's Wisconsin politics reporter for the Cap Times, with us today, checking in on the 2020 election investigation in Wisconsin by former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman and where things might go from here. There is certainly a bigger picture afoot. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, of course, there's an app for that. But when we're talking about teens, mindfulness, and mental health, how effective can an app on your smartphone actually be? We'll find out what the research says about the use of mindfulness apps by teenagers tomorrow morning on The Morning Show. Yet another exciting oceanic find out of Montana. According to the AP, a 4.5-inch fossil found in an ancient seabed in Bear Gulch, Montana, way back in 1988, sat in a drawer at the Royal Ontario Museum for years. And an astute paleontologist pointed out that this fossil that predates the dinosaurs is absolutely unique. This ancient animal unbelievably had 10 limbs. A closer look revealed evidence of an ink sac, making these remains the oldest known ancestor of the octopus at about 330 million years old. Now, we're only beginning to understand how smart these amorphous sea creatures can be, and now we're beginning to understand how old. The scientists who discovered this new pre-Jurassic species of octopus have named it Solipsipomodi bideni, after President Joe Biden, and they say his commitment to science and research. Say it again, Solipsipomodi bideni. This is Central Time.